Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But he was the MVP. He was the scoring leader. He was defensive player of the year. He won the All-Star Dunk Contest. He did everything but win a championship in that three. So a kind of a launch pad into all those other shoes and all the championships.
I'm Justin Jay. As a photographer, I've gotten to shoot rock stars, hip-hop moguls, world-class athletes, and some other truly extraordinary subjects. I'm fascinated by the backstories and life experiences that help shape these compelling people. The right photograph can reveal quite a lot about someone, but some stories can't be told with just a picture. Sometimes you need to sit down, listen, and dig a little deeper. This is The Plug.
We live in a world of compartmentalized fame. 20 years ago, it was unlikely that anyone could cultivate a fan base with hundreds of millions of fans without being known by the general public. But in today's social media landscape, influencers can create a massive worldwide network of followers, often without the knowledge of anyone that's outside of their niche community. If you don't believe me, just ask anyone over 40 who PewDiePie is. You're likely to either be a massive fan of today's guest, or you have no idea who he is. But his contribution to modern culture goes well beyond simply a TikTok video or a YouTube tutorial. He's been a major force in the sneaker industry for decades, and he's consistently pushed the boundaries of what's possible in footwear design. During his time at Nike, he collaborated with LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, and countless other legendary athletes to produce some of the most iconic and beloved sneakers of all time, from the Air Jordan to the Air Max. He's widely considered to be one of the most influential sneaker designers of all time, and he's quite literally the Michael Jordan of Jordans. So how did he help transform a utilitarian item meant to be worn on your feet into an entire sneaker culture where shoes had become a highly valuable commodity sold for thousands of dollars? We'll find out as we sit down for a chat with this college pole vaulting star come celebrated footwear designer. Today, innovator, patent holder, designer, and trusted collaborator to some of the most elite athletes on the planet, Mr. Tinker Hatfield. Tinker Hatfield, thank you so much for sitting down. I know we had some technical difficulties, but we finally made it happen.
I have technical, physical, mental difficulties. Just, you know, it's all in line with the how I operate.
So I found that you occupy a really interesting place
in pop culture. And, you know, since we have booked this podcast, I've been doing kind of an informal poll of some of my friends asking if they knew who you are. And the responses tended to be very binary. It was either, are you kidding me? Oh my God, of course, he's legend. Or who is that? You know? And I'm curious, like, you know, is that cult status something that you find funny? I mean, how do you reconcile that?
I just don't give it much thought. I guess if pressed, my impression would be there are some people that are really into design and really into sneakers. And if you are, then you would probably be aware of who I am and what I do. And then there's this whole other part of our society. And I think that's true that everybody's kind of fractured and you get interested in what you're interested in and maybe you tune out other things. I don't know. I mean, but yeah, you're right. I can walk down the street in certain neighborhoods and just get overwhelmed, or go through an airport, sign 40 autographs, or I could be, and no one even notices who I am. I mean, it's one or the other.
It's really fascinating. I feel like most people are not in that category. So I shot a book project recently, and I spent a lot of time on the North Shore of Hawaii chronicling surf culture over there. Uh-huh. John Florence is a two-time world champion, amazing, phenomenal surfer. He's been working with the same board designer, John Pizel, since basically his entire career. And, mm-hmm. you know, one of the reasons that partnership works so well is not just that John's a phenomenal surfer and an amazing test pilot, but he's really talented at being able to articulate minor design changes and how that affects the performance of the board.
Right.
That's not always a common trait among surfers. I mean, I think if you talk to shapers, a lot of times they'll say, yeah, sometimes surfers will come back and they'll just be like, yo, that board doesn't work or something like that, you know? And so, you know,
the board sucks.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I think that's why that collaboration works so well with the two of them. And they've been able to progress so much because they can actually do tests and see how A leads to B.
Right.
That said, I'm curious what your collaboration and what your process looked like working with Michael Jordan, because I know you mentioned in an interview that he didn't really open up and really kind of let you into his head and his heart until almost the Jordan 20. And, you know, if that's the case, what did the process look like for the previous 16 shoes that you collaborated on?
Well, I think that he's a private person and he has to be, you know, and that's just what we all observe with people who are that well known, and they tend to try and protect themselves, their family, whatever. But no, I really actually got to know Michael quite well. I would stay at his house and hang, you know, and there'd always be somebody else there, like Jay-Z or you know, some football player. You know, there were all kinds of people that were hanging around. And so, but when we would sit down for a design session, we both agreed that there'd be no one else in the room. And he really, really makes designing very easy because he actually likes the process, which is probably maybe what John does. But he also can articulate the differences or the new needs or some deficiency or some, there's usually some very specific nugget of info that he would pass along to me. And then that would allow me to, of course, then go back and then figure it out. In reacting to that conversation, I would come up with something and then go back and show him. And he's like, oh yeah, I love it. Because he could see that he could try the product on. But he could see that his involvement had an impact on the design, and therefore things would then go forward smoothly. And that I can tell you that he's rare. He's rare for like you said, maybe others. There are a lot of surfers who might not do that, but John does. And I would say that's true in probably every sport. That there are some athletes that really are dialed in, and they want to communicate and tell you what's going on and get really specific. Kobe Bryant was like that too. And that helps immensely, you know, in terms of improving performance. And then of course, in our business, style starts to get kind of infused into that performance process. So the problem solving for performance is job number one. It is at Nike. It is for me. It was it has been for Michael Jordan. And then you hope that it just ends up looking cool. And maybe because there's a second narrative that gets woven in.
So the collaborative paradigm that you were able to create with Michael Jordan, was that something that clicked right away, or was there a real long ramp up process?
It didn't click right away because Michael was actually somewhat unhappy with the way things were going. I think just in general, the Chicago Bulls were not that good his first year or two. And he really made a sensation though, because he was obviously really good right off the bat, but they didn't win so much. And he was wearing the Jordan 1. And then when he switched for the second year in the Jordan 2, which was a very technical shoe, but it was, I don't think that he had as much input into that shoe, and he didn't have any input into the first shoe because he was new. He was young, he was new, and they were like, man, things had happened really fast. And he broke his foot. And I think that upset him, and maybe I don't really know if he truly blamed the shoe, but you could infer that maybe the shoe was like in the back of his mind. Maybe yeah. wasn't quite the right shoe.
And just for the sake of the listeners who may not know, you did not work on those two shoes, correct?
I did not. I was the corporate architect, but I was close with the designers because I was doing work, and I would talk to the designers all the time about their spaces or their showrooms or stores or presentations of, you know, whatever. And so I knew all the designers, and I also knew that they weren't necessarily that versed in developing a relationship with the athlete to the point that the athlete was a collaborator, a co-instigator, or whatever you want to call them. And then when I was thrown into the fray to do the three, it was really, I think everybody was hoping that I would do something that would get Michael back into good graces with Nike in his own mind. He was always in good graces from Nike's perspective, but he was ready to leave. He was ready to go to another company. And I guess my timing was good that I came up with the Air Jordan 3, and he absolutely freaked out.
And the rest is history.
I guess you could say the rest is history, although, you know, it didn't always go smooth, but you know, we became a team after he saw the three. And then, so I think every year he trusted me more and more because the shoes were just off the hook in terms of his ability to play and be comfortable. And he wanted to wear a new shoe for every game and all that stuff. And he was starting to win, you know, and he was starting to, you know, in the three, which is, I don't know if your listeners care, but he was the MVP. He was the scoring leader. He was defensive player of the year. He won the All-Star Dunk Contest. I mean, he did everything but win a championship, you know, in that three, which had not happened yet. He had not won all of those things before. And so, you know, it was a perfect storm. And then, again, a kind of a launch pad into all those other shoes and all the championships.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. It was wild. I think, you know what? I'll bet you, you know, maybe when John was first working with that shaper, well, I'm sorry, his name is
John Pizel.
Yeah. Yeah. So Pizel, by the way, I have one of those. I have a Pizel board, which is weird. But anyway, you know, it probably took John a little bit of time to, you know, sort of like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. And then they develop not only a collaborative working relationship, but maybe a friendship too on top of it all. So,
you know, with that, on that same topic, I was fortunate enough to shoot a couple Nike basketball campaigns a while back. And while that was going on, there used to be a private store in Soho in New York where you could be invited and go in and work with designers and make your own sneaker. And I was lucky enough to be invited, and I went in. And what I found so fascinating is that most of the other people in there that were getting their shoes designed, everybody would bring these kind of inspirations and, you know, mood boards or whatever. But they didn't bring color palettes, and they didn't bring pieces of fabric. More often than not, it was songs or pictures of a landscape or a story, like these very abstract inspirations. Uh-huh. And And I'm wondering, you know, when you first sit down to work with an athlete, do you take a similar approach? I mean, is the jumping off point for you often something that resonates on an emotional level with the athlete rather than showing them a piece of leather?
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes, because, you know, when you're out there looking for inspiration, you're also checking the boxes off on the criteria list for performance. And those things are all kind of like, you know, expected to be done right. And the shoe is supposed to be a better product than its predecessor. So you check those boxes off. I really didn't like getting into materials and or colors for that matter until I actually had another story to tell. So there's two stories. One is, okay, here's how this shoe is going to be better than its predecessor. Number two, here is what I found as inspiration, and the story could vary from being inspired by a Lamborghini or a Ferrari, or possibly a song, or a woman's fashion runway show, or, I mean, it was just all over the place. And I would, I remember like coming in and talking to him about Afropop Worldwide, an NPR radio show. And it was, I saw just this beautiful poster in a record shop window. And that became the inspiration for how the shoe and the technology of the shoe and the performance of the shoe was going to blend with something that was going to make it also very interesting looking, you know? And then I would get a kind of an authorization from Michael then to pursue that. And then there would be materials and there would be colors. And so it was like maybe about the third or fourth meeting down the row before we started to actually look at those more visceral things, because I wanted to be inspired by a story and then go from there.
That's fascinating. So I was reading a book recently called Flux, and it deals with these tools and strategies that you can use to kind of address and anticipate the unknowns of the future. And they gave two really interesting case studies. One of them was coffee. And they were saying in the late 60s, early 70s, your choices for coffee were basically a big tin can of Folgers or a big tin can of Chock Full of Nuts. Like, that was basically it.
Sure.
And they cited sneakers as well. I mean, basically you had Chucks and Keds. And in broad strokes, that was pretty much your only options.
Uh-huh.
Those markets are obviously billion-dollar sectors now, multi-billion-dollar sectors. What I found most interesting about those examples is that both of those things grew to where they are today without a ton of emphasis on technology. Granted, there's been major developments of sneaker manufacturing and technique and materials, but not nearly to the extent of, let's say, a cell phone, which needed a cellular network and satellites and microchips and this big infrastructure behind it. And it seems like, you know, with coffee and with sneakers, what was more important was, you know, really brilliant marketing and branding, but most importantly, like the fostering of a culture behind those items. Like, do you think that's a fair statement? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, there are definitely, I don't want to undersell the importance of technology as it pertains to cushioning or safety, you know, not spraining your ankle, you know, basically being able to play 80 games, you know, whatever the pros play. You know, there's that. But I have to sort of agree with you that there's this more instant gratification around the love of sneakers. If you see it and it speaks to you, then you want to find out more about it, or maybe you purchase it. And I think if, with coffee, well, you know, you have a great, you know, espresso or a really great brand of bean, of coffee beans or whatever, it has a big impact on whether or not you're going to buy that again or get into it, you know. So I think when you talk about more advanced technology, like, and you use cell phones as an example, you know, that stuff takes years and years and years to sort of, I mean, Apple doesn't like turn out a new phone or a new iPad every 6 months or 9 months or even a year. It's usually longer than that. Our consumers they expect new stuff every, you know, pretty much every season. You have to, like, I think, take a few steps forward, but you don't have usually enough time to, like, reinvent the entire notion of what a sneaker is.
Yeah.
And I would say that has happened. Maybe the Huarache was something like that, was really different, or maybe the Back to the Future sort of self-lacing shoes, where there's a lot of new technology and it really changed sneakers a ton.
Yeah, I mean, those are great examples. And like I said, I don't want to by any means diminish the technological advances and, you know, performance elements that you guys have added at Nike. But in broad strokes, just the development of a culture where getting a cup of coffee, quote unquote, is really just shorthand for spending time together.
Uh-huh.
Or the entire sneaker culture, which is not really performance based. It's more like visceral, you know, it's more of cultural based.
Yeah. You know, I go back to the song. It was basically a remake of Summertime by DJ Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince. And they redo the song Summertime as a rap. Basically, they tell the story of a summer day in Philadelphia. The song just tells you all throughout the song, kind of it's moving through the day. And they talk about sneakers. Like, I got to go change my sneakers because I'm going to go do some hoops and there's girls there. And that storytelling about what it's like to be in Philly on a nice summer day and all the fun stuff and all the people, all the interactions. And there it just happens that sneakers just happen to be a pretty big part of that, because you might switch your sneakers out to go do some one thing versus another. And it's all visceral.
Yeah. It's all
about, you know, feel and maybe being attracted to somebody else or whatever. I mean, those things are all real and important. And I think it's one reason why sneakers have gotten so big, is that they're not seen as these new technical innovations as much as they're extensions of one's personality, and you choose the right shoe for the right moment.
Yeah.
Or right.
Well, let me ask you this. So I'm not a huge sneakerhead, but I definitely have some friends that are. And, you know, in talking to them, there's one theme that seems to be consistent. And that's, if you were to stand next to them in front of their collection of sneakers, they could tell you for every sneaker, the price they paid, where they got them, and in many cases, like the backstory behind that sneaker. Like, there's a real story.
Yeah.
A real story that's connected to those sneakers. And I know you've talked a lot in interviews about the importance of the story from the design standpoint.
Yeah.
I mean, even like the Jordan 20, it basically has his life story graphics,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
on the sneaker. And do you think that this relatively new notion of the sneaker with a narrative, or the sneaker as a storytelling device, do you think that was crucial to sneakers becoming the phenomenon that they have, or the success of the Jordans?
I personally do, because I've seen it and done it in person or read about it. And then, of course, I've had these conversations with famous, famous athletes who would just simply tell you a story about how they always lusted after a pair of Jordan 8s, because when they were younger, their parents couldn't afford them. They never got them. And then when they finally made it big in the major leagues or in basketball or football, whatever, they were able to get them. Or they might even ask for them because they were maybe Nike athletes. And it's like these pinnacle moments in one's life, whether it's a positive one or a negative one, they're real memorable moments. A lot of times they're attached to a sneaker. And my recollection is that growing up, like you said, I either wore Converse or Adidas, and I don't have any. They weren't special. They were just sneakers that you wore just to get through your day. But music, you know, music was something that I remember. Like I hear a song and it reminds me of something important in my life. And I think that sneakers sort of, I'm not going to say that music still doesn't do that. I think it does. But sneakers just have become another trigger for memories, good or bad. And so that means they have meaning beyond just being urethane foam and rubber and some kind of leather textile. You know what I mean?
Can you point to a particular chapter, or maybe even a particular shoe, where there was a split where the sneaker became not this utilitarian thing that you wear on your feet, but like a tradable commodity, you know, because, yeah, you know, sneaker culture, yeah, and the resale market, there's like this whole world out there. I was doing some research. The Virgil Abloh one, that's an $80,000 sneaker. You know, the M&M Cement 3, $65,000 for that sneaker. Yeah. Like, how did we get, yeah, there?
You know, that's I think that somewhere along the line, modern urban sort of youth culture, you know, just crossed a line, and sports crossed a line, and they met and they blended. So people were assuming, you know, but I think people were affected by who was wearing the shoe, you know, like an influencer. The influencer could be Michael Jordan or a Charles Barkley or, you know, Penny Hardaway or whatever. But also the coolest guy in your neighborhood might be an influencer. And so those things kind of affect people. You know, a lot of times there would be focus studies done, you know, with a new, like especially Jordans, because Jordans were always so unique that the marketing group were unsure whether or not they could sell the darn thing. And they would do focus groups, and the focus groups generally were not successful. Those shoes were not loved by focus groups because they were so different. But then when you saw Michael Jordan wearing them, or you saw LeBron wearing them, or you saw Jay-Z wearing them on a stage or in an interview, or it started to then change, I think, the way people thought about sneakers. It's like, oh, that guy is cool, or that girl is cool, therefore that sneaker is cool. And it just sort of kind of blew up. And I think that especially hip hop culture too, that, you know, that really blew up or blossomed at the same time that sneakers were. And you could say, well, you know, sneakers partly were augmented by the growth of that kind of hip hop culture, or you could say kind of hip hop culture sort of was aided by these sneakers. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of player. I would love to read a book that really, really dug deep into sort of trying to describe why all that happened the way it did. Being limited edition, like, or being really difficult to obtain, drives the price for collectors just through the roof.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, that because we had on Alex Corporan recently, and he was the store manager for the original Supreme store for many years. And we also had on Damon Way, who is the co-founder of DC Shoes. And we talked a lot with both of them about this relatively new practice, especially in streetwear, of intentionally limiting production supply and how that, yeah, how that funds demand and desire. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like when you first started working on the Jordans, if you had the retail price and you could afford it, you pretty much had access to those shoes. Is that right? I mean, you guys didn't really traffic in doing limiteds.
I think in general that's true, but I do remember long lines when a shoe was going to drop, and people not getting them because they were too far back in the line. Yeah. So,
that was incidental just because there was such demand, but that wasn't strategic on Nike.
It wasn't strategic at all. I don't think we understood the phenomena for quite some time. We were just trying to do great performing products that happened to just also look more interesting than anything before them. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, you know, I was playing this game of, what do I think will capture the imagination of people, and what kind of stories can be told around the process as well.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's LinkedInJobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Currently, or you know, in the recent past, how involved are you in the marketing decisions in terms of determining the production numbers or the price point of any of the shoes that you work on?
Zero. Zero. And it's kind of purposeful on my part, but also I think there's just people that know more about that part of the business. But really, I have to tell you that my strategy was I was there for the athlete. I was always there working to make a better product for the best athletes in the world, or the, you know, just everyday athletes. But that was job number one. Job number two was to make them, you know, cool and interesting, you know, and make them interesting. So that's a collaborative process, and you're always thinking that I'm working on this right now, but I also, this has to go well so then I can do it again and again and again. So that kind of means that with any of the athletes, you do not want to be seen as a business person. You want to be seen, and you want to be authentically be a collaborator with that particular influencer.
So from the athlete's perspective, you want them to kind of perceive there being a firewall between your role as a creative and Nike's role of trying to sell these shoes.
Absolutely. If they think that, I mean, I always felt like if an athlete thought, or an influencer could be a rapper or a, you know, performer or somebody, I mean, if they actually, I always felt like if they actually thought that I was more of a businessman than I was a co-creator, a collaborator, or some kind of designer extraordinaire, that was way better. And they were more excited about just taking my calls and inviting me down to their house or whatever. And I think that had I also been part of that, those business decisions could affect somebody in a very positive way or a negative way. I mean, they goes both directions.
And are there any, can you cite any examples where maybe you really disagree with the way that Nike handled a shoe? Like maybe a shoe that you were very proud of, but nobody could get. And I mean, do you have like kind of a egalitarian approach that you want everybody to be able to have your shoes, or do you appreciate the kind of exclusivity that some of these sneakers have adopted?
Yeah. I learned a long time ago to just let that water run under the bridge, let it go over the waterfall and not even think about it. And the reason for that is by the time a particular product makes it to the marketplace, and let's just say it's in a store, I'm deep into another design. You know what I mean? It's kind of like my job. I tried to just compartmentalize into being a performance product designer and a what I would call kind of an artistic innovator, you know, which when you combine those two things, you get interesting products. And then I would just stop there.
Nike's had some serious highs and lows over the course of its history.
Sure.
That doesn't really affect your approach to design?
No.
You stay away from that?
No, Not at all. And I don't even pay attention to any other companies. I don't even look at their shoes. I don't look. I've always been driven by my own instincts and, of course, the collaborative process, whomever that was. I just have really had kind of strict rules about that, and I just didn't want to be affected by it. And it's been a successful approach for me. And even though in the end I might have disagreed with something, kind of in hindsight, at the time I'm too busy. I'm too busy. I'm traveling around the world. Meeting with Drake one weekend and, you know, LeBron James the next and Kobe Bryant a week after, you know what I mean? It's just, and you know, I've got projects going on in all different directions and Olympic athletes too. And, you know, it was just plenty. I had plenty on my plate, and therefore I had to just basically let everything else go. You know what I mean? So the answer to it is, I had really no interest or really any knowledge about what the prices were going to be, how many they were going to make, or what the merchandising group and sales group at Nike were going to do. It's not that I didn't care. I didn't think it needed, it helped me, you know? Yeah.
You wanted to insulate yourself from all of that. Yeah.
I think so. And I think I also wanted, again, to be perceived as a friend or as a collaborator, not as a business person.
Interesting. Your path to become a shoe designer came through the background of architecture and also being an athlete yourself. Is that common or rare at Nike? And is that unique to the sneaker division? Like, in other words, if you're a designer in the apparel department, are you more likely to come from a background in architecture or from fashion? Because, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between those disciplines, yeah. But it ultimately leads to the relationship between, like, problem solving and personal expression.
I'd say it's kind of a mishmash. I don't think you could say that there are more fashionista type people at Nike and fewer ex-athletes or a combination thereof. I think it's just all over the map. And I think Nike has I believe there are 700 or 800 designers at Nike. I have no idea how many of them have a sports or athletic background, or I don't know the percentage of those, of that number of designers that are fashion driven or been to fashion schools. I mean, I used to help hire designers, and we'd tend to look at industrial design as a fertile ground for finding good footwear designers. And if they happened to have some interest in, or maybe some experience in sports, so much the better, but it was never a solid requirement.
You know, as someone with such a keen eye for design, I'm curious, like, in your daily life, do you have examples of things that from a design perspective just really offend you? Like, you know, just random industrial design. Like, for instance, when Damon Way was on, he was talking about he cannot stand the headlights and the taillights of the Toyota. And he's personally offended by it, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, do you have something similar that you encounter every day that just gets you?
Now, you know, I don't get that emotional about it. In other words, I can't say that I really love or really hate anything. I'm a good observer. I think most designers that are successful are good at observing. And I'll say, this is how I'll look at it. Oh, that car has a friendly face. And that car has an angry face. Yeah. And I don't make a judgment about it. I just notice, you know, so cars with round headlights and a nice little grill, they're kind of like eyes with a smile. And like Toyota, they're like slits and they're angled, you know, there's angled metal kind of giving them an eyebrow and kind of like they're more, it's a little more severe, a little more aggressive, I guess you could say. And I don't pass judgment on it. I just say, oh, you know, that designer was, or that group of designers was probably trying to be aggressive and, you know, was looking to a certain segment of the population that would be turned on by that. And yet other designers are like, you know, I'm going to do a cute car, and a car that people that's lovable by a different group of people. And so I try not to be judgmental about that. And, I know a lot of designers, architects and product designers and fashion designers, who are very judgmental. And I think maybe that helps them, but it just never occurred to me that that was helpful.
I mean, do you find that most bad industrial design is lack of attention to detail or just purposeful, but with bad taste?
I think it could be all of the above. It could also have a lot to do with the decision makers above the designers and what they, the kind of impact they have on the design, because that does occur in a lot of companies. And, you know, a designer might have the product altered by someone else because higher up person decided that it needed it.
Did you always, or do you now, do you have final cut, so to speak, in the sneakers that you create?
Yeah, I do. I think I had gotten successful enough when Nike was smaller and I developed, a sort of armor or protectionism, but it just seemed like people probably just trusted my decision-making more because of the success of the products. They were just blowing up all over the place.
Yeah. I'm looking back on your collection and all of the sneakers that you've gotten to work on. Is there one that stands out that you wish you could do different? Is there one, I don't want to say a mistake, but is there something that just like always just kind of gets under your skin and you wish you would have handled differently?
Yeah, I've been asked this question in a different way, but I'm going to try and answer it also in a more unique way. The Jordan 15 was a product I wish I had back. And the reason for that is because I had been through a lot. I'd done so many Jordans by then, and my father had passed away. My mentor, Bill Bowerman, had passed away. Michael Jordan's father had passed away. I was overworked. I just had so many other projects besides the Jordan projects. And I think I just was just, you know, I just didn't bring it. You know, it was like, I didn't mail it in, but I just think I could have done a better job with it. And it still ended up being a very unique shoe, but it's not one that ever makes it into the pantheon of the best Jordans ever. And I think there's a good reason for it, which is I think I was just worn out and sad.
Well, I mean, I'm curious, is there a different way of looking at it? Because rather than saying that you didn't put the effort or you mailed it in, I mean, is there a chance that all of that sadness and darkness in your life and Jordan's life, then when we talked about how important the story is, like, did that creep into the story? Is that an effect? Or do you think you were just too tired to do it how you should have?
I wish I had it back so that I could have used that darkness to finish that shoe off better. There was, it was an X-15 fighter plane or something. And also I'd been looking at Prada shoes, and I don't know, I was just sort of kind of all over the map on that shoe. And so then when I finished that shoe, and then then immediately I jumped into the 16 and I started it, and I realized this one was going to be an even worse situation for me. And so then I asked Wilson Smith, a very promising young designer, and actually probably the more appropriate person to sort of pass the torch to at this point. And he did the 16. I started it, but then he really nurtured it along and then finished it. And then there were other designers that stepped in. And then when it came to the 20, Michael called me up and said, "You got to do the 20." So I'd had some time off from the Jordan line, and I was ready to jump in and do something unique for that. So,
switching gears for a second, how important is your physical environment to your design process? I mean, I know people can find inspiration from a pencil or a song or a cloud. Does that really affect you on a day-to-day level? Or could you find, if you had to under pressure, iPad and a stylus, you could go into a box and make a great creation?
I think I could go into a box, but I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. My best work, and I think almost all of my work, is actually an affectation or a result of all the experiences that I've had in my life up to that point. So if I had lived in a small community in the middle of nowhere for all these years, I would have a smaller backlog or palette of things to work from. And so I am purposefully a world traveler. I'm a participant in all kinds of crazy sports. I'll try anything. I'm a bad surfer, and I've had some hold downs, and I shouldn't be out. But, you know, all of those experiences, or going to a concert and listening to somebody very weird and unique, all of those things end up in my subconscious mind. And when I sit down to design, I believe that those experiences affect whatever I draw, whatever I think of. And so if I've been in a box all these years, I have precious few things to be working from.
So you can go into a box, but it's all of those resources from the entirety of your life that you can call upon when you're actually putting pen to paper.
I mean, now I could go into a box because I have a pretty good backlog. But I think really, if you want to stay relevant as you get older, I'm 70 years old, and people are like, what, you're that old? I mean, you can't believe it. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm 70, but I do stuff alongside 30-year-olds or 25-year-olds. And I go to rap concerts. I mean, I snowboard off the top of mountains and ski and surf and put myself in all kinds of crazy situations. And I think that adds to, again, my ability to stay relevant and continue to do interesting work. So
that's amazing.
There you go. That's my final answer.
We always like to end the podcast by asking the guest to plug something that they're not directly involved in, but they feel isn't really getting enough attention, whether it's a book or a movie or an artist, a cause, or maybe a brand. Like, is there something that you want to kind of give some shine to that you want people to know about that you're really feeling right now?
It always boggles my mind that really great work doesn't necessarily catch on for a variety of reasons, I suppose. But having said that, you know, I also know that great work needs to be appropriate for its time and place, but it also needs to help people move to a new place. So it's kind of a fine line between being appropriate, but just nudging its way forward. And, you know, I can think of a lot of products or maybe even music that kind of does that. So in the world of music, as an example, I feel like there are jazz artists that are not well known or not understood. And I think that it really bums me out that the greatest musicians of our time are, you know, kind of like have small audiences. And that's just more of a general comment. I will sort of twist your question a little bit into a different mode, which is Jean-Baptiste, who has been a jazz artist, and now he's becoming a more pop jazz and maybe a little bit of rock and blues out of New Orleans. I see him breaking that glass ceiling for performers like that, for artists like that. There's another artist from the same neighborhood with the same level of talent. Stage name is Trombone Shorty, and he isn't jumping that curb. You know what I mean? And Trombone Shorty is amazing. I'm not going to judge him against Jean-Baptiste, but they're from the same neighborhood. They're the same age. I know Trombone Shorty, and he's told me all kinds of stories about Jean-Baptiste. And I didn't answer your question the way you might have hoped, but
no, those are great examples, because I think a lot of people are not familiar with either one of those artists, or particularly Trombone Shorty. So they'll give people a chance to check them out.
Yeah, I think that people should check out the artistry, but they have soul, and they have what Carlos Santana would say. They care about each note. They get to the heart of those notes, and they're true artists. And it's not just a bunch of stuff, you know, that someone else wrote. I mean, they're really feeling it, and they have the ability to make it beautiful or interesting or something danceable or whatever. So I think that's kind of something that I wish, I wish more artists like that would get a little more attention.
Well, Tinker, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to have this conversation. I know you're an incredibly busy guy. And just to clarify, you stay out of marketing decisions, so you are not the person I should hit up for the next quick strike drop, right?
I am always like, what the hell just dropped? I don't even know. Oh, yeah, God, I guess I shoot, who can I call to get one of those? I mean, I don't even know. I have no clue.
That, I find that hilarious.
It's actually been a good strategy for me because I'm not affected by all that stuff. Trying to keep my files a little bit cleaner and more organized, but still full of color, you know, full of interesting adventure. But I don't know that thinking about all that other stuff would be helpful.
Well, it's been such a pleasure getting inside your head, and I really appreciate it. And I wish you all the best. Hopefully our paths will cross soon.
You come highly recommended. Of course, I've seen a number of your podcasts anyway, and I want to thank you. It's been an honor to be chosen to visit with you, and it's always fun. And this will be yet another thing who knows? I'll probably design something based off of this conversation. You never know.
I'd be very honored. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for listening, and a huge thanks to today's guest for dropping in. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and take a minute to rate, review, follow, or subscribe. This episode of The Plug was executive produced by Peter Buckingham, with original theme music by Andrew Van Weingarten and Dan Drohan. Logo design and branding by Italic at www.italic-studio.com. Sound design by Brad Worrell at Soundwag. And you can check out my photography at justinj.com. Thanks again, and be sure to tune in for future conversations.
And don't forget to post your job for free at linkedin.com/surf. That's linkedin.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.